The millere was a stout carle for the nonnes, full big he was of bran and eke of bonnes, that proved well, for over all there he came. At wrestling he would have alway the ram. He was short-shouldered, broad, a thicke knara. There was no door that he nold have of hara, or break it at a renning with his head. His beard as any sore fox was red, and thereto broad as though it were a spada. Upon the cop richt of his nose he had a werta, and thereon stood a tuft of harris, red as the brussels of a sowe's heiress. His nose a therles black aware and weeder, a sword and buckler bar he be his seed.
With just a few lines, a great writer can bring to life a character that lives for centuries. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The poet bringing that miller to life is none other than Geoffrey Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales. It's a dazzling look at society in 14th century England and at the same time a look at human nature of all times. And the two collide cheek to jowl in poetry that ranges from the vulgar to the sublime. Guiding us through the writings of Geoffrey Chaucer is Lisa H. Cooper, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Hi.
Before we talk about Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the writings themselves, give us some sense of Chaucer the man, because I think even though Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is one of the most famous works ever, most of us don't have a very distinct view of Chaucer the man.
Well, that's a fascinating question, because scholars are still looking for a distinct view of Chaucer the man, and this is what's very peculiar. I mean, we know some basic biographical facts. Chaucer lived from around 1340 to 1400 in and around London. And his last name, Chaucer, is really the French chausseur or shoemaker. But we know actually that both his father and his grandfather were wine merchants, vintners. And therefore we know that Chaucer was actually from the merchant class, and yet he rose to become a counselor to and writer of poetry for the aristocratic elite. And most of what we know about Chaucer the man is about his political career. He was a major civil servant at a time when England was developing a more and more efficient bureaucracy. And he actually worked for and under three kings, as a matter of fact, in many different capacities. As a young man, he was a soldier. He then was a diplomat who traveled on the king's behalf to France, to Spain, to Italy. He was an important customs official. He lived in the customs house in the gate over Aldgate in London. You can still go visit the site. He was a member of parliament. He served as clerk of the king's works, which means he was in charge of all royal building projects in 1389 to 1391. And he was, in short, a very public figure. So we know a great deal about that public life. And in fact, in a collection called the Chaucer Life Records, there are some 493 documents about this very public life. And what's fascinating is that there's absolutely no reference in any of those documents to his poetry. And so what we know about Chaucer the man is a sort of odd conglomeration of the stuff in the public records and then what little we can glean of his self-presentation in the poetry.
The poetry was considered, what, just a hobby and not really worth mentioning?
Absolutely. In the later Middle Ages, as, you know, maybe today, poetry, the practice of poetry was not something you did for a living. You didn't get paid to write poetry, although you could receive gifts from your patron. And we do think that Chaucer was awarded gifts. He, for example, got an annuity at one point of a yearly ton of wine.
As if he needed that.
Right, exactly, having come from a family of wine merchants. And so we do think he was probably awarded gifts of various kinds for the poetry. But again, there's no record. And in the Middle Ages, poetry, sort of the writing of poetry, is justified as that which is sweet in order to be useful. The Latin poet Horace talked about the need for poetry to be both dulce, sweet, and utile. It's sort of, you know, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down sort of thing. So the goal for poetry, theoretically, is that it be both sweet and useful.
What about Chaucer, the family man? I mean, he writes a lot about marriage, all kinds of marriages and so on. Can you say what is known about his private life?
Well, we know that he was married to a woman named Philippa. We know that they had two children, Thomas Chaucer, about whom we know also a lot from the public records because he became a government figure after his father. And then he had a little son named Lewis, about whom we know nothing at all except that Chaucer dedicates one of his most practical prose works, the Treatise on the Astrolabe, to him. And that's about all we know.
They were out of the limelight. The English language was doing some interesting things by the time Chaucer starts to write in the 1360s.
Yes. Well, Chaucer is writing in what we call Middle English, which is a kind of, to oversimplify, amalgam of Anglo-Saxon, which was the language spoken on the island of Britain before the coming of the Normans across the Channel in 1066. And Anglo-Saxon is a Germanic language. It then encounters, shall we say, Norman French once the Normans are the ruling aristocracy in England. You mix that up with Latin, which is the language of philosophy and of course, the church. And you come out in 1360 with this language that's very much in the process of development with all kinds of borrowings from French and Latin and Anglo-Saxon to produce this kind of marvelously flexible language that Chaucer makes all kinds of use of. He will deliberately sort of highlight good, strong Anglo-Saxon rooted words. Then he'll use French for the language of love and government, or not French itself, but English words that have come into the language from French. And so it's very much a language in a process of transition.
Can you read a little bit of what you opened the hour with and illustrate that, how that is Middle English?
Sure. Actually, it would be better to maybe start with the opening of the general prologue, where we really see Chaucer sort of bringing things together. So the general prologue is the first, I'll read the first, I don't know, 10 lines or so of the opening of the Canterbury Tales, and then we can talk about the language there. So, "One that April with his shores sota, the drocht of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor. When Zephyrus ache with his sweeter breath, inspired hath in every holt and heath the tender croppers, and the younger son hath in the ram his half a course ironna, and smaller fuelles machen melodia that sleepen all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh him natur in her courages. Than longen folk to gone on pilgrimages, and palmerers for to seeken strange strandes, to ferne halways caught in sundry londes, and specially from every shearer's ende, of England to Canterbury they wende, the holy blissful martyr for to seeke, that him hath holpen, one that they were seeke." Now, these are some of the most famous lines.
Well, they're pretty, aren't they? Actually, you know, I think Middle English is prettier than English or French.
It's quite a beautiful language. And these 18 lines, probably a lot of listeners will actually recognize them. They are the lines that very frequently students of Chaucer are made to memorize. It's a good party trick, right, no matter what sort of.
Kind of random. I mean, there's no particular reason for picking these lines. It happened to be the first whatever 18 lines of the poem.
Actually, I think there is a reason. And so we can talk about that. I mean, first to answer Emily's question about language. So we begin with, "When April with his sweet showers has pierced the drought of March to the root and bathed every vein in such liquor of which virtue," which here really means power, "by which power the flower is engendered," right? So we have all of this sort of scientific, natural language about rebirth with good sort of French words and good Latin words like liqueur and vertu, right, coming from the Latin
very
virtus,
French.
Right? And then it's also very French. And engendred, right? It was just this good French, engendered is the fleur, right? And then more Latinate stuff, when Zephyrus, when Zephyr, the god of the wind, has blown things. But then, line six, "When Zephyrus has inspired hath in every holt and heath." Right, so inspired, this is actually the first, if I'm not mistaken, it's the first use of the word from Latin inspirare, to breathe into. It's the first use in English poetry. Right, and so what we have is the idea of breath being blown in, but also, I think, hidden there, the idea of poetic inspiration.
Oh, the invocation, mm-hmm, of the muse,
yes,
that was such
exactly,
a standard.
Right, as if Chaucer is sort of hinting to us that he – that not only is Zephyrus blowing fresh air onto the land, but he, Chaucer the poet, is blowing new life into English poetry. And then we get this every holt and haith and pretty much almost all of the one-syllable words for land, animals, and body parts in our language today come originally from Anglo-Saxon. And words like holt and haith, right, the field and the heath, right, these come – right out of, you know, good Anglo-Saxon pasture language, right, and farming language. So we have agriculture encountering sort of French ideas of love, Latin ideas of inspiration.
Well, so it is in a way a microcosm of the poem in terms it sets the stage for what you're going to get a lot more of, the ordinary mixed in with the more ideal or idyllic.
And with the cosmic, yes, absolutely, mm-hmm. right? This poem begins with this kind of glance at, you know, the human calendar. You know, we're in the month of April. March is almost over, right? And here in Wisconsin especially, we can talk about April showers and May showers and probably June showers as well. So we have this look at, you know, one type of calendar combined with the mythological, with Zephyr, and with the seasonal. And then that meets, you know, the land of England and the birds and the animals. And then we meet these people who want to go on pilgrimage at this time of year.
Something about mm-hmm. the springtime makes you want to travel.
That's right. The birds want to sing and folk want to go on pilgrimage, right, to Canterbury. And so they are going on a spiritual journey to the shrine of Thomas Becket at Canterbury. But at the same time, it's spring and it's time to have fun. And so this poem sort of begins with both this vertical look at the heavens and thinking about heaven itself and the saints, but also it's a horizontal glance across the landscape of England, the holt, the haith, the path from London to Canterbury.
And the gate known as the Canter, full name originally, the Canterbury Gallop.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Right. And so we're headed there. We're headed to this shrine. And then the question is, you know, what exactly is going to happen on the way? And we sort of really see Chaucer sort of bring up the fact that things are going to happen by chance when he continues the rest of the beginning of the general prologue, because he gives us this whole large scene and then he focuses in on himself. The folks are heading off to Canterbury, and then befell that in that season, on a day in Southwark at the Tabard, as Eli, ready to wenden on me pilgrimage to Canterbury with full devout courage. So Chaucer's taking a rest at the inn in Southwark, right, and he's ready to go on his own pilgrimage. And into Canterbury comes, as he says, well 29 in a company of sundry folk, be aventura ifala in fellowshipa, and pilgrimers were they all. So it's a company of sundry folk, right, who have fallen by chance into fellowshipa, fellowship, which is a word that Chaucer only uses a couple of times throughout the Canterbury Tales at, I think, very important moments. And so it's a group that has come together by chance. And it's only by creating this structure of pilgrimage that Chaucer can really assemble the kind of random collection of individuals that he does. It is only on, say, in the marketplace or really on pilgrimage that you would bring together so many people from so many different walks of life in the same place.
They're going to the scene of the martyrdom of Thomas à Becket.
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Yes. Right. They're going off to Canterbury where Thomas à Becket, who was murdered supposedly on the orders of Henry II or on the suggestion of Henry II in the 12th century, they're headed off to his shrine together.
And what does Chaucer do with that eye voice, that persona? To what extent is it Chaucer? To what extent is it a construct of this pilgrimage?
Well, that's almost the same question as saying, what do we know about Chaucer the man, right? Because what we have throughout here is a tension between, in fact, when you even teach Chaucer, you have to talk to your students about Chaucer the poet, the person standing outside of this fiction, Chaucer the pilgrim slash narrator, the character or persona that's created inside the fiction. And what he does with it is to pretty much all the time gently poke fun at himself. He does give himself two stories, tells two stories on the road to Canterbury. One of them is cut off abruptly because the host who's leading the whole group doesn't find it good. And Chaucer, the pilgrim, then responds with a long prose tale that many modern readers have found extremely dull. professional medievalists have begun to find it very fascinating, but it is a moral sort of sermon tale that one doesn't have one's students spend very much time on.
And who is Chaucer writing this for? Do we know much about the audience and how it would have been delivered or read?
We really don't know. I mean, we know that many of his poems, for example, one of his earliest works, The Book of the Duchess, was, we know, written to commemorate the death of Blanche of Castile, so member of the nobility. And so we know that Chaucer's poems were circulated among the London aristocracy. But we don't really know much beyond that. We especially don't know for whom he was writing the Canterbury Tales. One of the fascinating things about all of Chaucer's poetry is that he seems to write without patronage. Right? Most medieval poetry of this period and even later begins with a gesture of, you know, my lord so-and-so has asked me to write this, or I'm a broke poet and I'm writing this for my lord in the hopes that he will notice me. Chaucer, however, is doing something very new and different. He just, and again, that word inspired there really seems
felt
to
like
resonate with that. Mm-hmm. It just seems like a project he wanted to engage in. And so we really have no idea. And the very fact that what we have in the Canterbury Tales is a collection of many different types of narrative with different types of appeal, what Chaucer does is he actually animates the question of who are these for by having, after each story, sort of audience reaction to the story that's just been told. And different types of people tell different types of stories.
Let's look at some of those people and their stories when
sure.
we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The millerer, that for drunken was all pala, so that uneth upon his horse he sat, he nold avale neither hood ne hat, ne abide no man for his courtesia. But in Pilate's voice he gan to cria and swore, be armus and be blood and bonus, I can a noble tala for the nonus, with which I will now quit the knictus tala.
Not exactly a devout pilgrim approaching Canterbury, that miller that we began this hour with, and where you have a little bit more of a picture of him there. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Lisa Cooper. Our topic is Chaucer, and the lion's share of that has to be the Canterbury Tales and those wonderful character descriptions. Every line has some little extra bit of information that brings these people to life.
Absolutely. And so with the quotation with which we began the hour, we get the description of the miller as someone who's stout and full of brawn and bones, and that he, we're told, he can overcome anyone at wrestling, and that he was short-shouldered and broad and wouldn't hesitate to heave doors up off their hinges or break them at running with his head or by running at them with his head. So the miller, we're told right at the beginning, is someone who breaks down doors. And what he does at this moment in the Canterbury Tales that I was just reading is insist on following the knight who's told the first story very appropriately for his rank and status in medieval society. The miller's breaking in to the storytelling order and insisting that he's going to tell a tale next. He's going to quit or quite or requite the knight's tale, right? And so what he then goes on to do is tell, the knight has told a story of courtly love that takes place among the aristocracy in ancient Greece, in the ancient world. And the miller tells a very contemporary tale about a carpenter and his wife and the scholar who boards with them and who works out a very clever plan to commit adultery with the wife while the carpenter actually sits in the roof of the barn waiting for Noah's flood.
He's in a bathtub or something. This is a sitcom,
he's in some,
really.
It really is a kind of, it's a masterfully carpentered, shall we say, story. It is a of the genre we call fablio, which came out of France in the late 12th century. And this is Chaucer's. He writes several fablio in the Canterbury Tales, and this is the first one, and many people think the best. A short story of domestic farce, usually involving cuckoldry and erotic jokes of one kind or another, and there are any number of them actually in The Miller's Tale. So we have a scholar living with a carpenter. So intellectual labor faces off with manual labor. And at one point, the scholar actually says to the wife, oh, don't worry, a clerk's not worth much if he can't fool a carpenter. And the scholar tells the carpenter that a second Noah's flood, a second flood, is coming. And the only way they're going to be safe is if he puts kneading tubs high up in the roof of the barn. And at the right moment when the waters rise, they'll be able to cut the tubs and float free. So the carpenter is spending the night up in the roof of the barn in his own little tub while Allison, his lovely young wife, and Nicholas, the handy scholar, have a good time in the marital bedroom.
It does seem odd to me that Chaucer would have the miller tell a tale about another working class figure who's cuckolded by a scholar. You'd think it would be somehow that the carpenter would
tell a
triumph.
What's interesting about millers is millers sort of sit on the fence between manual labor and the sort of rising middle class. On the one hand, millers perform manual labor. On the other hand, they make an incredible profit. And, for example, in 1381, the moment known as the Peasants' Rebellion, or more often now the Rising, 4 days in June, when the peasants from outside of London sort of advanced on the city armed with pitchforks and other farm implements and burned down palaces and destroyed documents, some millers stood with the rebels and some millers were the target of the rebels' ire. And so millers are in this kind of curious in-between position. Right? However, the reeve, who is a manager of land, but in his past, we're told, was a very good carpenter, gets very upset about a tale that's been told about a cuckolded carpenter. And he, in retaliation, tells the very next story. He quites the miller with the reeve's tale, which is a story about a miller whose home is invaded by two clerks or graduate students from the university. And they manage to spend the night with the miller's wife on the one hand and his daughter on the other. And so that's where we really see the professional competition really begin to be one of the driving forces of the forward movement of the Canterbury Tales.
So kind of a one-upmanship, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. Yes.
You tell a story about one wife and cuckoldry, well, I'll get two women in my story.
And one of the things that Chaucer is doing throughout the Canterbury Tales is really formulating, in fact, the idea that we still, I think, have about our literary tradition, which is that each writer tries to both use what has come before and one up in some way, right? And that's sort of being dramatized by what the characters on the Canterbury Pilgrimage are actually doing. And the miller tells an inverted version of the knight's tale. The reeve tells a sort of another version of the story that the miller has just told. And then the cook, and this is the last tale in what's known as Fragment 1, because the Canterbury Tales comes down to us in the manuscripts in what are known as fragments. It is not a complete book from beginning to end, and there's even some disagreement as to what order some of the tales should actually come in. The cook sort of rounds things off, or tries to, at the end of Fragment 1 by telling a very short, indeed seemingly incomplete narrative about an apprentice who runs away and ends up living with his friend in some disreputable part of London, and the friend's wife keeps a shop and sweeves for her sustenance. And the word sweeva means to copulate in Middle English. It's very closely related to the verb swinka, to work. Right? And so work and sex sort of come together, as it were, at the very end of Fragment 1 in a way that seems to shut things down. And what we have even in the manuscripts is sort of a blank page after that, as if once you've collapsed the metaphors for work and sex and the making of money, there's nowhere else to go.
Well, and did Chaucer have to worry about censorship? Because a lot of these tales do have bawdy parts. And so I'm just curious, did this have to go past?
It seems unlikely, doesn't it?
No, it really did not. I mean, one of the things that always surprises people, I think, coming to Middle English literature or to medieval literature in general for the first time is that medieval readers, although I hate to generalize, you know, with that very broad term, but were very used to sort of the sacred and the profane existing side by side.
Right? And it was a profane that was very blunt, too. I
mean, yes.
There was nothing circular or euphemistic about it.
I mean, one of the best examples we have as evidence for this is, you know, the survival of medieval manuscripts, that often you will have a prayer book with prayers in Latin on the center of the page and then the beautiful decorations known as marginalia that often have very obscene things going on in them. You often have women chasing men with distaffs, the spinning implement. You often have various kinds of scatological activity happening in the margin. And so it's very clear. And yet these are illuminated in beautiful colors and gold leaf. And then in the middle, you'll have a nice Latin prayer. And so it's very clear that there really wasn't as much of a problem as we might imagine with this kind of blending of the sacred and the profane. The Miller's Tale is actually a perfect example because the Miller begins by saying, I will tell a story, a legend and a life of a carpenter and of his wife. Now, in the Middle Ages, the word legend or life refers to a saint's life. And as soon as someone says, I'm going to tell a saint's life about a carpenter and his wife, you're immediately thinking, okay, this is going to be the Joseph, Mary, and Jesus story. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what any medieval reader would at first, or listener, would think. And then we get this profane narrative that is at the same time based on Noah's flood. Right, so Chaucer is really mixing things together, and the reaction that he gets from the audience members in the frame tale, or what's called the frame, is that everybody thinks this was, except for the Reeve, who's angry, everyone else thinks this was pretty great.
He does this one trick occasionally, and he does it with the cook, and he does it later with the pardoner in maybe a more serious way, where he describes the character perhaps fairly sympathetically and then undercuts him. Like the cook, he says, he had this wonderful white sauce. It's a shame that he also had this running sore that was the same color.
On his leg, yes. He sort of builds in, Chaucer builds in little warnings. And this reminds me of something I had meant to mention earlier in response to Emily's question. Chaucer does warn us in a very kind of postmodern moment before the Miller's Tale that something bawdy mm-hmm. is coming up. In a sort of very famous moment, he apologizes, first of all, because Chaucer, the narrator, says, look, I'm just repeating what these folks said. Right? That's all. I am just the messenger, effectively. Right? And he says, you know, don't take what I say the wrong way. I have to rehearse what everyone says. And then he says, and therefore, whoso listeth not Ihera, turn over the leaf and chase another tala, for he shall find enough a great and smalla of storial thing that toucheth gentilessa and ache moralite and holinessa. Blameth not me if that ye chase amiss. So he says, turn over the leaf and pick something else. There's plenty of other stuff here. Don't blame me if you make the wrong choice, right?
Wow, it's viewer discretion advised.
Yes, it's basically viewer discretion advised, and Chaucer saying, you know, put me out of blame, he says, and men shall not make earnest out of game. Right? Letting you know, this is funny stuff. You're not to take it too seriously. If you don't like this kind of thing, turn over the leaf. And that in itself is fascinating, since the fiction of the Canterbury Tales is that we have a group of 30 people speaking to one another. And this is a moment where that fiction is broken for Chaucer to remind us that we are actually turning the pages of a book and that it's really up to us.
One of the most famous tales in the Canterbury Tales is the Wife of Bath's tale. And that brings up the question of sort of a more dominant, forceful woman than the ones we've encountered so far.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the wife bursts onto the Canterbury pilgrimage with no apology. And she in fact, starts speaking without any she speaks a very long prologue. Her prologue is, in fact, longer than the tale that she tells. And, in fact, when people think of the Wife of Bath, they rarely remember that she actually does tell a story in addition to the very long narrative she tells about herself. And she begins with, experienza, though non auctorite, where in this world is rict enough for me to speak of woe that is in mariage, right? I have experience of how bad marriage can be, and that's enough. I need no authority. And the word authority comes from the Latin auctor, author, right? So she's saying, I don't need any texts. I can just talk from my own life experience. And then she does at great, great great length. And what she does, and this takes us back in a way to the Cook's Tale, where we ended with the scene of prostitution and sweaving for your sustenance, is to defend her right to use her body however she wants. Now, she is a successful cloth merchant. She's the wife who lives beside Bath. That's what wife of Bath means. And she's made her money in textiles. But she doesn't want to talk about that. She just wants to talk about the fact that she's been married 5 times and welcome the sixth whenever he should come along. And that's what her whole prologue is devoted to. And she uses different types of textual authorities, such as the Bible, to defend her rights. And she says, for example, "I will bestow the floor of all minage in the actes and in fruit of mariage." Right? I will take the flower of my age and bestow it in the acts of marriage. Right? And she talks at great length about how God bade us to be fruitful and multiply. What's fascinating is she never mentions any children. And so
the thought that counts.
It's the thought that counts. And also what the wife does is multiply herself through language. Right? She may not have had any children, but she does have this seemingly endless supply of words. And she, in fact, claims that God gave women 3 skills, deceta, weeping, and spinning. Deceit, weeping, and spinning. Right? And she's, in effect, making some references back to actually the fall from the Garden of Eden there. But she's turning God's punishment on womankind, right? That they will weep in pain and in childbirth, and the original deceit that happened when Eve got Adam to eat the apple. She's turning that into a gift, right? Women can trick men, and they can cry a lot to get what they want, and they can spin. And there she's referencing the sort of archetypal women's work of spinning. She is herself a cloth merchant. At the same time, Chaucer, the poet behind the Wife of Bath, seems to be making a reference to the Latin word texere, which is the verb for to weave, the past participle of which is textus, meaning something woven, from which we get our word text. So in fact, whenever there are references to weaving, cloth, and so on and so forth in medieval literature, there's always this Latin pun behind there to the idea of spinning tales. Right, and so there's a way in which we can actually see the Wife of Bath and her ability to spin tales. We can see in her a kind of figure for the poet himself. And actually, a lot of critical ink has been spilled on to what extent through the Wife of Bath we can see Chaucer as a proto-feminist or whether he's actually a complete misogynist. Is this a version of here's woman at her absolute worst, or is this is what women would say if they were given this kind of an opportunity?
Well, she has these malapropisms in there, doesn't she? I mean, she quotes Latin and uses it the wrong way.
She uses things the wrong way. Well, she never gets it completely wrong, but she just insists on reading it the way she wants to, right? She is, in some ways, an author's, you know, nightmare of, like, the world's worst reader. One of the things we learn about her in the general prologue, just as we learned the Miller's great at knocking down doors, we learn that the Wife of Bath is a little bit deaf, which seems to key us into the way that she mishears, misunderstands.
And
or
she got deaf because one of her husbands smacked her in the ear, right?
Well, that's
so
right.
So that adds a little... more depth to
it. But he smacked her in the ear because she ripped 3 pages out of his Book of Wicked Wives, which he liked to read to her every evening. And she got a little fed up. And all he would do was sit there and read all the stories, beginning with Eve in the Garden of Eden. She got a little tired of that. And so one day she gives up talking and rips pages out of his book. She, and then he hits her in response. But then she lies on the floor and plays dead. And he leans over all concerned and she hits him, and eventually she gets what she seems to most want, namely sovereignty, which is actually the theme of the story. Right. She then goes on to tell about a knight who is sent on a quest to find out what women want. And what they want is mastery over men.
And it seems pretty amazing that Chaucer, at this time, writes this way about a woman in the stories.
I suppose, except that, you know, on virtually every topic we can think of, Chaucer seems to have a take that is fresh and surprising. And I think that's one of the – that is the reason that we keep reading him, is that we see something in Chaucer's narratives and in his poetry that is more familiar to us than much other literature written at this period. There's much here that we find in common with our own ways of thinking about the world, including not only a great sense of irony, but a sense of sort of self-reflexivity, self-consciousness, ambiguity, sort of all the things that we still look for both in literature and I guess even in our own lives, Chaucer is doing in a way that his contemporaries do not. That actually makes him very unusual for his time. Were we to really read medieval literature historically, or as medieval readers read it, we would spend all of our time reading books of sermons or exempla or moral tales. We would not be spending all of our time focusing in on the Canterbury Tales.
Well, you need a little bit of balance in your diet, right?
That's right. Sententia and solas, as Chaucer would put it.
Speaking of religion, let's look at some of the religious figures in the Canterbury Tales when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Lordings, quod he, in churches one precha, e peineme to han an hoten specha, and ring it out as round as gotha bella, for I can all be rota that I tella. Mi theme is alway on, and ever was, radix malorum est cupiditas.
Those are the opening words of the Pardoner from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Lisa Cooper. We're exploring the world of Geoffrey Chaucer. Since this is about a pilgrimage, it obviously is going to touch on religion.
Yes.
But Chaucer, not surprisingly, gives us a kind of ambiguous religious figure here.
Yes, he does. And there are several members of the ecclesiastical hierarchy on the pilgrimage, the most curious and suspect and shady of whom is the Pardoner, who, like the Wife of Bath, is one of these outsized characters on the pilgrimage. And like the Wife of Bath, he too prefaces his rather short tale with a very long tale about himself. And the lines I just read are the beginnings of the Pardoner's explanation to the characters on the pilgrimage about how he preaches. And he's very explicit about the fact that his goal is to dupe his audience in order to get money. So he says, you know, radix malorum est cupiditas, greed is the root of all evil, is the theme of the sermons that I tell. And then he explains just how greedy he himself is. He says very clearly that of avarice and of switch cursednessa is all me preaching, for to make him fray to yeven herpence and namely unto me. For mean intenta is not but for to winna, and nothing for correction of sinna. My intent is to win. I don't care about correcting sin. Now, a Pardoner, just to explain briefly what that is a figure who sprung up sort of in the shadow of the Catholic Church's doctrine of purgatory and the sale of indulgences, namely selling time out of purgatory. So you would pay for your sins and you would be buying yourself an indulgence a certain number of years out of purgatory following your death. And this is already, I realize, sounds extremely corrupt, and it became even more so in the later Middle Ages. And pardoners often worked without licenses. And our pardoner, we're told, is licensed in the general prologue, but it's a little unclear if he really is. And he explains in full, as I said, how he dupes his audience. He says he shows off his seal of his authority, and then he says that he speaks some words of Latin to saffron, he says, his preaching, right, to spice up. And saffron in the Middle Ages is worth more than its weight in gold. And so we get this reference in a Middle English poem to Latin as the kind of thing that spices it up, right? And so he spices it up, and then he says that he shows forth long crystal containers that are crammed full of bones. And what he's got is a shoulder bone, and he's got a bit of cloth that he says is the sail of St. Peter. And he admits freely that these are all fake, right? And so just as his – and so one of the questions he says actually at the very end of his opening to then his longer tale, the moral tale he tells, he says, though myself be a full vicious man, a moral tala, yet iu tella can. Right? I may be a vicious man, but I can still tell a moral tale.
And that tale that he tells is worthy of Hitchcock, isn't it?
I mean, yes.
So the plot is so tight and the end is so twisted and yet comes out of the story.
I mean, and it's absolutely. It's a story about three young men who go on a pilgrimage looking for death. They've taken the idea of death literally and they say they're going to go find death and kill him. What they find is a pot of gold under a tree and they end up all killing each other in an attempt to try to win the gold for themselves.
And they find that pot by asking this old guy, have you seen death? And he says, yeah, I think he's under that tree.
That's right. He's just up this crooked path. And here's the thing. In medieval literature, when someone says, go up a crooked path to the tree at the end, as my colleague, Professor Seth Lehr at Stanford once put it, the allegorical light bulb should be going off, right? The crooked – go up the crooked way to the tree and that's where death is. And yet these young men take things very literally and they just don't get it. So The Pardoner tells a very effective moral story. And one of the issues that Chaucer is dramatizing here is, again, this relationship between the person and the persona and then the stories that come out of that person's mouth, something that, as I like to tell my students, is something that's very much still with us today, right? We judge narratives often on the basis of what we know about the character who tells them. And one of the things I like to bring up is, you know, when the book Primary Colors was published by Anonymous, mm-hmm. and we all got very worked up, right, because we want to know who stands behind language. Right. And so when we know that the Pardoner is this crooked guy, Chaucer's asking us, is there anything good to be recuperated out of his story or not?
And isn't it an additional layer of irony? If I remember right, doesn't he then ask for payment after telling this tale about greed?
Yes.
Is he offering to sell them some relics? And they say, you're just trying to get us to do something intimate.
Exactly. At the very end, the Pardoner says, aren't you all so lucky to have me? What a great story I've told. And I can sell you, you know, indulgences by, you know, the basketful should you need them. And then he turns to the host, Harry Bailey, the guy in charge, and says that they should come forward. Well, he says, I'll read the Middle English. Come forth, Sir Host, and offer first anon, and thou shalt kiss the relics every chon. Yea, for a groat, unbuckle anon the purse. Right? So come forward and kiss the relics.
The fake relics.
The fake relics. And then the host gets extremely angry and says, Nay, nay, quod he, than havi Christus curse, lat be, quod he, it shall not be so thetch. Thou wouldest mock mean kiss thine olde brecha, and swear it were a relic of a saint, though it were with the fundament de paint. And so the host says, you want me to kiss your old underwear and swear that it's a saint's relic. And then he says, by the cross that St. Helen found, I wish I had your collyons, Middle English word for the male, for the testicles, in my hand. Instead of relics, let cut them off. Let's cut them off. I'll help you carry them. And so we get this moment of extreme scatological humor, but there's a very violent edge to it, a very nasty edge. And there's a moment here of extreme anger. The host gets angry, the Pardoner gets angry, and the knight then has to step in and kind of calm the waters so that the pilgrimage, which is sort of halted here for a moment, can actually move forward. And one of the things that's also being played on here at the end is something that has troubled critics for a long time, namely the Pardoner's bodily and sexual status. In the Chaucer tends to, with these important characters like the Miller and the Wife of Bath and also with the Pardoner, give us sort of impressions of them in the general prologue that come back to haunt us when we look at their tales. And very crucially, we have our narrator telling us in the general prologue, and he's looking at the Pardoner, and he says, I tru he were a gelding or a mara. I thought he was a eunuch or a homosexual. And a lot of ink. In fact, probably more ink has been spilled on that one line than just about any other line in the Canterbury Tales, because what's at stake here is the Pardoner, are we being told that he is spiritually vacant? Are we being told that he is really so radically other that He is empty in ways that go beyond the spiritual. Is he physically vacant in some crucial way? And his bodily status and his sexual preferences have led scholars to go in all kinds of directions in trying to interpret what it is that the partner thinks he's doing when he reveals himself, or as some might say, when he comes out, at least about his practices when he gives his sermons, and then what's happening here at the end in this sort of very verbally violent exchange between the partner and the host.
You have a couple of nuns in the mix, too.
We do have a couple of nuns, in particular the prioress, who is a very delicate and dainty sort. We're told in the general prologue that she takes great care not to let any sauce fall onto her dress while she eats, and she has little lap dogs, and she cries if any of them get hurt. And then she tells a horrifically anti-Semitic tale, the prioress's tale, which is about a little Christian boy who walks through a community of Jews in far-off Asia and gets his throat slit because he's singing a hymn to the Virgin as he passes through town. And this is a tale that has, again, thinking about the difference between the tale and the teller of the tale, this has upset historically many Chaucerians. How could Chaucer, this figure we all admire so much, put this horrifically anti-Semitic tale into the pilgrimage? And what are we to make of that issue?
The most likely would be that he actually heard something like that from a prioress.
Well, either from a prioress or from the many tales of this sort that, you know, unfortunately circulated around England, stories of this kind. In fact, there are other versions of the tale that Chaucer does tell of sort of, you know, ritual murders happening in Jewish communities. Anti-Semitism was sort of a fact of life in the Middle Ages, and Chaucer is, in the Canterbury Tales, including virtually everything one can think of. And the prioress's tale is one example of that. That is a story, thinking about censorship, that in more modern editions of the Canterbury Tales have been censored out. Right? It's very often, if you get a collection that's not the full Canterbury Tales, that will be one of the tales that is missing. So we are the ones who censor far more than readers in the Middle Ages actually did.
You mentioned that the Canterbury Tales has come down to us as fragments. Is it incomplete then? We have more pilgrims than we have tales. And what does Chaucer do to provide an end?
Well, we do have every pilgrim. There were 29 plus the host. And each person was supposed to, according to the deal that the host strikes with them at the beginning, tell two stories on the way to Canterbury and two stories on the way back. Chaucer the pilgrim is the only one who gets to tell two stories, although one is cut short because the host doesn't like it. And to provide an end, Chaucer does a couple of things. He starts to wind things down as we approach Canterbury. And first, we encounter two figures who are not described in the general prologue, who just burst onto the scene, a canon and his yeoman, so another ecclesiastical figure and his assistant. But the canon's yeoman starts to reveal his master's secrets. It turns out that the canon is actually a would-be alchemist, and the yeoman has signed on to attempt to learn the art of alchemy, turning base metal into gold and searching for the philosopher's stone. And one of the things that the yeoman keeps saying, and the canon runs away because he realizes that his secrets are about to be spilled. A lot of people reveal secrets throughout the Canterbury Tales. And the yeoman keeps saying, well, the problem is you can't ever reach the end. You keep looking for the philosopher's stone. You keep trying to turn metal into gold, and you just can't reach the end. I signed up for this to learn to multiply wealth, and all I've done is, you know, failed to come to a conclusion and mired myself in debt. So he keeps saying there is no end, there is no end. And what's interesting is the appearance of this story in one of the last fragments of the Canterbury Tales. We then get the parson, who is the holiest of the members on the pilgrimage, and the host turns to him and asks him to actually wrap things up. And the parson then says, okay, that's what I'll do, but I'm not going to tell you a tale. Like, and he says, you know, fie on all tales, effectively. He says, I will tell you something in prose to knit up all this feast and mock an end, to knit up this feast or this festival and make an end. And in fact, those are some lines worth reading.
I will not gloss, I will you tell a myriatal in prosa, to knit up all this feast and mark an end, and Jesu for his grasa wit me senda, to show you the way in this viaja of thilka parfit glorious pilgrimage that hic Jerusalem celestial.
So we get the parson in what we're pretty sure, because of clues Chaucer gives us at the beginning, that we are really at the end. We know that Chaucer meant for the parson's tale to be the last tale on the journey. So the parson tries to wrap things up by saying, I'm going to remind you that we are on a pilgrimage, right? And that ultimately we are all on the pilgrimage of life trying to get to the heavenly Jerusalem. And so he tells a sermon about the seven deadly sins. Following that, in the manuscript, we have something called, that is now called, Chaucer's Retraction, although it's not titled like that in the manuscript, in which we get a voice speaking to us as if it were Chaucer the poet now, the historical man, rather than the pilgrim, saying that he hopes that anyone who hears or reads this little treatise, that if they like anything, that they thank Jesus Christ, and that if they find anything that displeases them, that they attribute it only to the writer or speaker's lack of wit and not to his will, that would full fain have said better if he had had cunning. I would have said it better if I'd had the cunning to do so. And so here we get something that at one point was taken straightforwardly as sort of Chaucer's deathbed confession, right? His retraction. And in fact, he particularly says that he particularly revokes, he particularly retracts the tales of Canterbury, thilka that sonen into sinna, the tales of Canterbury, those that sow sin. And the question then becomes, do we have here someone who is really taking back all of this wonderful stuff we've read through our travels with these pilgrims? Or do we actually have an author, again speaking in his ironic and very self-conscious voice, reminding us of everything he's written? And he gives us a whole list. Right?
Don't read any of the following.
Here are all the things that I take back, which really is the canon of Chaucer's works, including the Canterbury Tales, but also the House of Fame, the Book of Troilus, the Book of the Parliament of Fowls, and then he even says, and many another book, if they were in my remembrance, as if he's written so many that he just can't keep track
of them. The Astrolabe is okay, you can read that one.
That's right. Anything, and he says in particular that of the translation of Boethius and other such philosophical and spiritual works that, you know, that those he's particularly proud of. But really what we have here is one of the first kind of autobiographical bibliographies in the Western canon.
Lisa Cooper, thanks for being our guest and taking us to the wonderful world of Geoffrey Chaucer.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, our guest, Ellen Samuels, will look at literature and disability with us, and we'll look at fascinating characters ranging from Captain Ahab and Frankenstein's monster to Darth Vader. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.